Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. As we go from one end of the criminal justice system to the other. That's right. It's relatively easy, perhaps, to get into the hands of overly aggressive cops, then very, very difficult to get out of a prison system built on notions like three strikes and you're out, aggressive plea bargaining that compels people to confess rather than stand trial, and mandatory sentencing that restricts what juries and judges can do to take into consideration the circumstances of particular cases, narrow options for parole. That's our focus this hour. And we begin with the nation's chief prosecutor, Attorney General Eric Holder. You may have heard this. He delivered a critique of the back end of the criminal justice system yesterday.
The bottom line is that while the aggressive enforcement of federal criminal statutes remains necessary, we cannot simply prosecute or incarcerate our way to becoming a safer nation.
In one of those historic ironies, just a few hours earlier here in New York, a federal judge, Shira Scheindlin, issued a ruling broadly criticizing how this city deals with the front end of the criminal justice system. An NYPD approach to neighborhood policing and fighting street crime known as stop and frisk, you may be familiar with it, was deemed unconstitutional based on evidence presented in a landmark trial here in New York, Floyd versus City of New York. Stop and frisk permits officers to size up an individual as a possible criminal, relying on their own instincts and personal hunches, a test called reasonable suspect, rather than acquiring specific evidence to pass the much harder probable cause test. Well, Mayor Michael Bloomberg is proud of the policy. He spoke yesterday, calling the ruling dangerous, and declared that stop and frisk is an effective crime-fighting tool.
There is just no question that stop, question, frisk has saved countless lives. And we know that most of those lives saved, based on the statistics, have been Black and Hispanic young men.
But here's what's really interesting. This statement by the mayor, in a sense, misses the point, according to the judge in the case. Quote, this case is not about the effectiveness of stop and frisk in deterring or combating crime, Judge Scheindlin wrote in her 195-page opinion. This court's mandate is solely to judge the constitutionality of police behavior, not its effectiveness as a law enforcement tool. Many police practices may be useful for fighting crime, she wrote, preventive detention or coerced confessions, for example, but because they are unconstitutional, they cannot be used, no matter how effective. Judge Scheindlin said in her opinion that frisking individuals because they match a vague description, such as being young, Black, and male, violates the 4th and 14th Amendments. And what does that sound like?
They stopping and frisking us for what if we ain't do nothing wrong? We sitting on the bench with our mothers. Like, last month, I got beat up in front of my mother. I ain't got nothing against them, but it's just the thing they do is not right.
Many young men in New York, like that person interviewed by a reporter at our partner WNYC, testified at the trial about what it felt like to be stopped and frisked by the NYPD. Judge Scheindlin made it clear she was not shutting down stop and frisk, but she did assign an outside monitor, a special attorney, to make sure the NYPD's street searches and interrogations comply with the Constitution, and New York City is appealing the ruling. Well, what does a ruling like this mean in communities looking to New York as either a model or a cautionary tale? We have two voices with us, one from California, the other from Ohio. First, from Cincinnati, Cecil Thomas is a former Cincinnati City Councilman and policeman. Cecil, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So this ruling, does it say, well, they should have known better to you, or is it possibly too restrictive on police?
No, it should say that they should have known better. If you don't remember your history, you're bound to repeat the mistakes of the past. And this is what I saw evolving in New York when they changed their stop and frisk rules.
And how does that resonate with the history in Cincinnati?
Well, Cincinnati, back in the early 90s when I was a police officer, we saw a significant erosion in police community relations simply because we were using something very similar, a method, to what they were doing in New York. And in 2001, all of that erupted as a result of the deteriorating erosion of police-community relations, meaning that a certain segment of the population was being profiled. And as a result of that, we had civil unrest, bricks being thrown, fires being set, and people were saying we're frustrated with the way the police are policing in certain segments of the community.
Now, was the Cincinnati case adjudicated, and was it decided that the police were violating the Constitution? And what was the impact on crime statistics before the unrest?
Let's start with the request for the Justice Department to come into Cincinnati. They did come in, and they said that we need to take a look at your policing and your policies and procedures as relates to this particular issue. Well, the police department chief said, we're doing everything correct. You can look at our policies and procedures, and we are a model for the country, and nothing needed to be changed. Well, after the Justice Department looked at those issues, they saw that there were over 105 different areas in our policies and procedures that needed to be either changed, gotten rid of, or tweaked in some form or another. That then led into a memorandum of understanding between the citizens of Cincinnati and the police department and the city itself, where all of these things were tweaked and changed.
What do you make of the argument from leaders in New York that crime statistics, crime rates have come down, and it's largely because or in part because of the stop and frisk program?
Well, see, there's a delicate balance of what are you attempting to accomplish. Your crime rate may come down, but if you have an erosion of police community relations, you're going to see an escalation of another problem, which is the relationship between citizens and police. And all it takes is a spark to cause that delicate balance to be way out of kilter, which is what happened in Cincinnati. We had a spark where a police officer shot and killed an individual unarmed, and as a result, it erupted. New York is going down a very dangerous slope. And yes, you may see early results saying that, oh, crime is down. But then all it takes is that spark.
New York viewed through the filter of the history in Cincinnati, Ohio. Cecil Thomas is a former Cincinnati City Councilman and policeman. Cecil, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We turn now to Noel Gallo. He's a city councilman in Oakland, California. Noel, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What do you think of this decision? What do you think of what Cecil just said and Mayor Bloomberg's suggestion that stop and frisk actually is keeping the crime rate low in the New York area?
Yeah, you know what is, you know, Oakland's a city that's really being challenged by crime. I mean, we're at the top of the charge when it comes to murders, robberies, burglaries, car thefts, and so forth. So I believe that we need every tool necessary to be able to, you know, provide law enforcement in our neighborhood. I live in a neighborhood that's challenged because the reality is that my children are being murdered, my youngsters are being killed, and my grandmothers are now paying the price, and they can't even leave their home because, you know, they're being robbed, murdered at the same time that our children are.
All right, but what do you make of the judge's notion that, you know, you can do stop and frisk, you just have to follow the Constitution,
right?
And New York has behaved in a way that they're really going to need a monitor to really monitor what they're doing because they can't do it on their own.
Right. You know, in Oakland, we have the monitor, a compliance officer, and I even had the Bratton Group come to Oakland recently with all his chiefs to give us a strategic plan.
Former Commissioner Bill Bratton, that's who you're referring to?
Right. You know, we're under federal oversight as well. These are some basic tools that we currently need to deal with the violence that we're experiencing. So not only am I worried about the constitutional rights of those that are committing the crime, but, you know, there's other individuals that are being impacted, harmed, killed, that we need to think about their rights also to enjoy the privileges and liberties that this country gives
us. But there's a third group here, and that's what the judge was talking about, the constitutional rights of individuals who committed no crime but get caught in this dragnet. That's where the tension comes. That's where the unconstitutionality comes.
Right.
And that's really the issue.
Right. You know, and I'm Latino Mexican American, and I certainly live in this neighborhood. But the reality, there's some of us in my neighborhood that are committing these violent acts against our own community, and they should be searched and their weapons removed. We're caught up in the drug scene at the same time.
But I don't want to be argumentative here, but are you confident you can pick those people out? And is that a constitutional question that the Oakland City Councilman Noel Gallo can pick out who he thinks should be stopped and frisked?
No. I respect the constitutionality of everybody's rights. I understand that point. But at the same time, what we're doing here in Oakland, we have handcuffed our police officers, and they're not responding, one is to the calls, and they're not responding to where they need to be assertive and remove people from a crowd or from the street when they're committing a crime.
All right, we're getting a lot of reaction here. Noel, I want to go to that, but let me just ask you one very quick question. Do you support this ruling, or are you against this ruling in New York?
I support, you know, the judge made it very clear that it's not illegal. But at the same time, I do respect and I do support the constitutionality of our police receiving the training necessary to enforce the law.
All right. Noel Gallo is an Oakland City Councilman. We also heard from Cecil Thomas from Cincinnati, two voices around the country. How do you see this tension between law enforcement protection and law enforcement making people feel like they're the enemy? Kamar Davis and a young man named Joseph live in a Queens, New York housing project where they feel the police presence every day. Here's what they think of the stop and frisk decision.
Being that they can't stop and frisk, they'll probably pay more attention to, I don't know, like traffic violations. Whatever the case may be, they're going to be more strict than other departments because they can't stop and frisk. So they got to get their arrest somehow, right?
They don't care about what's behind the desk or what's on papers. They still going to be doing the same actions that they've been doing. That's just how they is. They ain't never going to change. And I don't think even if they ruled it as unconstitutional, a federal monitor is going to hold it any police officer back.
Those voices in New York collected by our reporters at partner station WNYC. But up in Providence, Rhode Island, one of you wrote us this. My son, who is brown, has been stopped and harassed so many times. He's 23 now. It's been happening since he was a teen, riding his bike home from a friend's house, stopped, put on the ground, frisked at 14 years old for riding his bike home for curfew. Happens all the time, so often that we have to teach our kids how to cope with their anger at the injustice. KQED listener in Albany, California, you told us, I've seen the police make a U-turn to check out a car with a black driver in front of my house on three different occasions. I had to intervene with the police harassing my son's black friends, too. After giving it further thought, I realized that perhaps due to the minute percentage of African-American residents in my city, they immediately consider them to be from somewhere else. And here's an assessment from one of you in Austin, Texas. The hip and edgy Austin, Texas, the fastest growing and most popular American city. I am a civil rights attorney, and we have a terrible metric when it comes to traffic stops and frisks of brown citizens and police use of deadly force incidents involving brown people. But there's another side to this.
This is Tim Herring from Tyler, Minnesota. I think our police do a fine job covering our area, which we're very rural. They do it with great dignity and respect.
Hi, my name is Janine. I'm calling from Sarasota, Florida. And I do think the police in my city are generally fair. Of course, the fact that they're human beings leaves room for error and judgments and mistakes. But I think given the fact that they are human beings, they do a pretty good job. Just the fact they put their life on the line every single day is awesome. It's something that I would never be able to do.
My name is Sarah, and I'm calling from Dallas, Texas. And I personally have had my life saved by a police officer, so I have a lot of respect for them, and I've had nothing but good interactions with any police officer.
Whatever your law enforcement story, we want to hear it. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And coming up, the verdict in the trial of Boston's most notorious mob boss. We'll talk about the decision in the Whitey Bulger trial next. Stay with us.